Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotheque, the podcast that gallops through the gallery of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm examining every brushstroke along the way.
So join us on our live quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Yes, welcome back to this mini-season of live shows recorded at the British Museum.
Yeah, it's been so lovely having these conversations and being able to now share them on our podcast feed with all our lovely listeners. And I think it's lovely to look at the films that we're talking about in these live episodes and almost view them as two sides of a coin. We've got Takahata and Miyazaki, mm-hmm. Four films, two each. And I think those first two that we've already spoken about, My Neighbor Totoro, Pompoko, in a way can be very illustrative of that first... Or the early stages of Ghibli for them, mm-hmm. and now we're looking at the back half, their last films, or Miyazaki's supposed last film.
Exactly. If there's any concern, listeners, that we covered these films relatively recently, they were both in the previous miniseries we did, don't worry, because what's great about these panels that the British Museum put together for us to host is that they had such a wide range of experts to come and chat with us. And this one we have not two, but three guests. And the value they bring and insight they bring is something we can't match at all.
Yeah, whilst I think I have some grasp on the work of like traditional Japanese pottery.
Exactly.
I mean, sometimes it's good to get an expert on that subject.
Yeah, well, so let's go through the panellists for this discussion. We have Hosono Hitomi, who is a ceramics artist living in London. She actually has a few pieces in the British Museum. She had a piece in the manga exhibition where she creates these intricate ceramic pieces where they look like fish and chips, but they actually have manga stories on them, painted onto them. Really something. And the link, I suppose, to this film is that Princess Kaguya is one of those Ghibli films where the artistry is so upfront. Thousands of man hours that go into animating this film.
The physicality of the process of animation is mm-hmm. so evident in this work.
We also have Uchida Hiromi, who was one of the curators of the manga exhibition, who gives another great insight. We had Nicole Roumanière on a previous episode, but Hiromi gives great insight into the Japanese curatorial side of this and the role Ghibli plays within Japanese art internationally. And finally, a name that was familiar to me beforehand, Raina Dennison, who is an academic based at the University of East Anglia who specialises in Japanese film, animation and Ghibli. She edited a collection of essays on Princess Mononoke. She contributes to Anime, A Critical Introduction, a Bloomsbury book. And what's amazing is that her current research, you'll hear her describe this in the conversation, but her current research is into the production history of Ghibli that we don't hear about over here internationally. And that's what we talk about every episode. Mm-hmm. So I think that Raina's insight is completely in our wheelhouse. And I'm just absolutely in heaven talking to her about this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think with all these episodes, we should waste no more time and cut straight to it.
But let's start, as we probably should always start with,
with Studio Ghibli.
Yeah, so it'd be great to ask all three of you, actually, what your entry point into Studio Ghibli's films were, and then we can kind of look at the links between that and the exhibition that we've all seen too. Raina, do you want to start?
My story is probably the least interesting. I got shown My Neighbor Totoro as part of a language class when I was at university 1,000 years ago. but when I saw this movie, I was blown away by it. And I remember going to Japan on my year abroad, and somebody said, you liked that movie with the big bear owl thing. Do you want to watch this one? It's by the same studio. And I sat down and watched Grave of the Fireflies for the first time. Oh. Cried for about a week. It was amazing.
I grew up in Japan. Every summer there is this Ghibli film release, and of course I watched it. And the first my memory about Ghibli is Nausicaa. Yeah. And there's so many times, really like more than 30 times I watched with my sister and brother. And I just like that how they draw the natures, and quite a big influence to my work when I was in Japan, actually.
It'd be embarrassing if someone hadn't seen it yet.
He hasn't seen it yet. Don't spoil anything for him. We'll get to that. We had to save one of the best ones for last, didn't we? So he'll see it eventually. Hiromi, what's your background, Ghibli?
I was also brought up in Japan, but I have to confess, I was more like a manga girl. And then I wasn't... when I was small, I was watching animations, of course, on television, like Heidi or like Moomin. Mm. But I have to confess, my encounter with Ghibli was quite when I was quite older, maybe like 20s or something. Uh-huh. And then that was Nausicaa, but it wasn't in the cinema. Mm-hmm. I saw it on DVD. And then next I remember is Spirited Away, which I saw in the theater, which was mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. I was really, really taken off. And then that was my kind of starting point. But I haven't seen all of the Ghibli film.
Yeah. Mm. I think Spirited Away is many people's starting points here, really.
Yeah.
But we should talk about Kaguya, really. Yeah, that's why we're here tonight.
Definitely. And I mean, I think all of us along this row, our first one was a Miyazaki film.
Is that really interesting?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's really nice to have the opportunity to talk about Takahata, who has been, well, for the podcast and my journey on that has been the great discovery for me, because a filmmaker who I knew nothing about, and this is for me is like one of his absolute very best works.
Yeah.
And such a pleasure to be able to watch it on a big screen like
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Just quickly, who saw Kaguya for the first time this evening?
Oh, wow.
We're so glad we were able to share this with you.
Maybe we should hear all of everybody's comments rather than
exactly.
Us.
So in a few minutes, we're going to have a microphone running around up and down the stairs. So we'll get some comments and questions from you if you want to start thinking. But let's just, I'd love to hear what we all think. We have, anyway, an academic, a curator, and an artist here. Hitomi, you mentioned how Ghibli inspired your work, but also watching this film in relation to your own artwork, which is this intricate ceramic pieces that require a lot of patience, hard work, and craft. Do you see that reflected in this film with the lines and the artwork?
Yes, there are lots of the places I can feel that there are so many craftsmanship happened in this film. And firstly, these lines, and we think that a lot of work give more quality, but actually, simple one lines can express so much. Like, for example, baby, when the Kaguya was a baby, when you see the baby crawling around on the floor, and you see so much movement, and almost feel like the soft skin that the baby have. But when you carefully look at it, actually the baby just maybe 6 or 7 lines.
Yeah.
And that's really inspiring. Mm-hmm. And all flowers and the tree, everything in the nature actually consists of really a few lines than the other, I think, animation film. And I think that was really wonderful. And then also, I quite like that the Kaguya and her mother enjoy craft so much, her pleasure.
Yeah.
And then I think that tells something. It's doing something by hand, Takahata thought. Mm-hmm. It's a really wonderful thing that the human beings.
Yeah. That's what's amazing about Takahata's films in general, is that he crams so much craft and culture into every one of his films. There, for example, in this one, you do have the scrolls and the line work and so on. In previous films, it may be looking into mythology or local history, or
In Pompoko, you've got real live TV and
like, in Only Yesterday, you have safflower flowers being turned into dye and so on. He's really interested in so much more than just telling a story. And Hiromi, in terms of the relationship between this film and the exhibition and also Japanese art in general, there seems to be so much of that in display here, and there's so many roots out of this film into Japanese cultural history, I'm sure. Yes?
Yes. And then also just I wanted to just follow up with what Hitomi-san mentioned. It's about line.
Yeah.
And then how simple line can be so expressive. And then this exhibition, the main theme, or like one of the things we wanted to express, is the power of line and then graphic power. And then, but it doesn't have to be quite minute or details. But lots of drawings we have, original drawings in the exhibition, certainly have a very skilled lines after lines, which is also good, but also in a kind of a traditional Japanese paintings, it could be a quite simple line, but it can be so expressive. And then it's something you also use your imagination, probably, how you communicate with the lines and then drawings, and then you just feel something behind it. You can see something behind it.
I think that's so true of so much of Takahata's stuff, and of that imagination, particularly in the scene where Kaguya breaks out of the palace, and it's just pure line work there, and we don't need to see whatever is filling out the background. We only need to see the essential elements, because that's all we really need to get to the core of the emotion in that moment.
Yeah.
So that we can, I think that somehow there is a nice to feel that how the artist who draw the scene experience emotionally the story. I think we feel really feels really kind of connected if the story through this artist hand-drawn lines.
Yeah, I was very fortunate when this film premiered in Toronto to interview Takahata. And one thing he said that in the realm of ultra-realistic 3D animation, you have Pixar working at such heights with Toy Story 1 and 2. For some reason, he didn't mention Toy Story 3 in that sentence. I wonder why. But probably because Totoro's in it, right? But therefore, go in the extreme opposite direction, to the point where a single line and you feel the animator's hand and emotion, as you say, and you really do feel that in this film. Reina, so much of the understanding of Ghibli, internationally at least, is defined through the lens of Miyazaki and his hits from Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke onwards. Takahata, for many people, including Jake right here, is something of an enigma, or his films aren't shown or talked about as much, apart from maybe Grave of the Fireflies. Where does his work fit within the academic world for you?
Well, within academia, we're still catching up with Takahata as well. But I think within Japan, he's much, much better known.
Right.
Certainly within Japanese academia, he's beloved there as well. I think one of the fascinating things for me about Takahata and about this film and its use of line in particular was the way they had to totally rejig the way they made films at Studio Ghibli to make this movie. So there's a wonderful documentary you can get hold of in this country now. It's a kind of 3-hour long making of this movie. And there's a wonderful observation at the beginning of it that this is not how Ghibli makes films. So not only was this film made at, I think it's studio number 7 for Studio Ghibli, so it's not made on the main campus, it's made somewhere else by a specialist group of people all working together to create something new and different, but they had to redo everything. They had to start from first principles in order to make this work. And so it's a really interesting continuation from what they were doing on My Neighbors the Yamadas, but also some of the more experimental things Studio Ghibli has done over the years, which we don't tend to see much of, because they tend to experiment more when they're making animated commercials for television than they do when they're making their feature films. So I think we've got something here that's really special, because it's not like any other Ghibli film.
Yeah. Mm.
There is actually a really nice bit in that documentary which covers or shows Takahata covering ground that he covered in Grave of the Fireflies, which is just the cutting of fruit. And he talks about how the movement of that animation in Grave of the Fireflies wasn't quite right. It didn't feel like how a knife should go through it. And so that's why we see in Kaguya doing that same thing again, because it took an extra 25 years to get it just right.
But that's the wonderful enigma that is Takahata. On the one hand, he's experimental and he's trying new kinds of art with animation. But on the other hand, he's really almost obsessively concerned with how things are really done, about realism. And he's not just an animated filmmaker, he's also made live-action documentary. Mm. He's someone who really does care about the world around him, and so you see that in the everyday details. I think we see that in the observation of how a frog jumps, or in how a garden grows, you know.
It's really observation of the people, really wonderful, like the father wiped his hands before pick up this moment. Beautiful small princess. That's so natural, like we do after the toilet sometimes.
But I do completely agree. It's just so natural. And then also the movement with using just simple lines. But so then I think, so it must have been a bit challenging for Takahata to create this animation, because this is based on the kind of old Japanese story, a folklore, which is originally just a text, and then it does describe about this kind of treasure things like all the princes were talking about, but it doesn't describe in details. It just like a drill, and then it. And then Takahata had to represent or like create it on the as a kind of visual. So that's where probably his imagination comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, there are wonderful stories from Takahata's career about him being, for example, on Only Yesterday that you mentioned a little while ago, that's from the early 1990s. He was obsessed with a puppet show that had been on Japanese television. And he wanted to make sure they recreated it properly, but they couldn't find it. So he sent this poor production assistant all over Japan looking for this one episode of television that he vividly remembered, but no one could find. And I think it took them quite a few months to track it down and find it. But it's there in the background of one scene. You know, this is the level of realism that he really cared about. If you look at the kind of brochures and the pamphlets they put out for Takahata movies, they almost always have a couple of pages in them that are about the stuff that appears that is real, that they've had to go out and recreate in animation for the film. And I think we see this in the art in this movie. It's so beautifully, carefully reconstructed. The scrolls and everything look so perfect.
Yeah, I suppose he was quite fortunate in a way that he was given license to experiment in that way. I suppose after maybe Only Yesterday onwards, he wasn't making box office movies in the way that Miyazaki was all the way through. He'd be making the bank for Ghibli. I think Kaguya was only able to be made over that long decade plus period because of an endowment by an old benefactor who wanted to see one more Takahata movie, and I think he passed away before the film
just
was finished.
Just before it came out, yes.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's cheer up the mood by asking the audience a question. Do we have a microphone out there? Straight on the beneath you there on the end of the row. Thank you.
So that was the first time I've seen the movie, and I wasn't really familiar with the storyline at all. And it started off in this super charming way, and there were moments of real kind of fun when they're in the capital. And then that ending was absolutely brutal. It was so tragic. How common is it in Studio Ghibli and in anime generally to have a super tragic ending, you know, not softened at all for the audience?
Have you seen Grave of the Fireflies?
No, I haven't.
Well, that response should give you some sense of that has one of the most brutal, well, I think entire film really is quite brutal, but the ending of that film is one of the most.
Just to really heighten that heartbreak, actually do it as the original double bill of My Neighbor Totoro, because that will really like boost you. You will feel great after that.
So. But to give a broader answer to your question, anime is famous for having devastating endings and being unafraid to kill main characters. Mm. And this is part of why it really took hold in the kind of mid-1990s in the outside of Japan, because it was so different to the kinds of stories we were hearing otherwise from Western animation.
Yeah, although specifically within Ghibli, I'd say, apart from Kaguya and Grave of the Fireflies, that's the hard stuff.
I've cried at Ponyo.
I mean, you will cry for different reasons. They're not as emotionally devastating, perhaps. Do you cry at many of these, Jake?
Yeah, I cry at these.
No, I'm just thinking, any specific films that made you tear up?
What have I cried at? I cried at Only Yesterday, Whisper of the Heart, Totoro, Fireflies.
Okay, so ignore what I said. Okay, fine, many emotionally devastating films.
I feel like they're really beautiful, happy films for the most part.
Another question or observation out there. I see a green sort of top here in the middle.
Do you think it would be possible for another production like this to happen now? Or the kind of commitment to an artistic ideal that they had, that's just not possible anymore?
It's interesting to mention that, considering Studio Ponoc and Takahata.
So, you are familiar with Studio Ponoc at all? So, no. One thing about Princess Kaguya, and Raina, correct me if I'm wrong with any of these points, was that this new way of making this film introduced a new generation of producers, in particular one producer, Yoshiaki Nishimura, who produced Princess Kaguya, and then after this film and when Marnie was there, were released, Ghibli closed for an indefinite hiatus.
Briefly.
Yeah. Reopened a year or two later. But during that pause, Yoshiaki Nishimura went and formed a new studio called Studio Ponoc on the similar principles with which he had been taught by Takahata, Miyazaki, and Toshio Suzuki. And he poached a bunch of filmmakers from Ghibli, mainly Hiramasa Yonebayashi, who made Arrietty, their Borrowers film, and When Marnie Was There. And they made this film, Mary and the Witch's Flower, which you say made on these principles. It's not as nowhere near as experimental, but it's made almost as, how have we put it before, Jake?
It's like a really great Miyazaki cover band.
Yes. But Raina, I think a broader question is this sort of experimental fringe of mainstream, well-produced, high-budget anime, can we ever have that again?
I mean, part of why you can have a film like this is because at that point, Studio Ghibli had been massively successful. They're outselling everything in the Japanese marketplace. Mm-hmm. The only person who's really done that since has been Makoto Shinkai, mm-hmm. Whose amazing film, Your Name, broke all sorts of box office records.
Talking about films that made me cry.
But I don't know whether he's as interested in putting his money back into experimental mm-hmm. styles of animation as they were at Studio Ghibli. I think time will tell in that regard.
Yeah. I hope that answers your question a little bit. I think that Takahata was one of a kind, really, in Japanese animation, with a career spanning six decades that really pushed the boundaries. And he wasn't an animator himself, and that gave him freedom to be almost, I keep calling him the Alex Ferguson, it's becoming a dated football reference, but somebody who knew how to get the right people for the job to bring his vision to life.
There's a wonderful story about one of his early films with Miyazaki, Hall's Prince of the Sun, mm-hmm. where
the film didn't do very well at the box office, largely because it didn't get a very big release from Toei. But one of the interesting things about it was they made it very egalitarian. So they looked for everybody to talk to them and tell them about their good ideas, and they put them in the film. And that's one of the ways Miyazaki got his really first big break at Toei Animation. And what's interesting is the stories I'm reading and hearing about Kaguya say there was a similar thing going on in that little studio number 7 with that little team making Princess Kaguya. They seem to have been very egalitarian, very open to everybody's ideas. And I think that's maybe why we get so many of those cute moments, so many of the fun moments, so many of those beautifully observed natural moments as well. Those wonderful scenes with the kingfishers and the frogs and the dragonflies. You know, I think that's not just pure Ghibli, that's also people loving this movie and putting their heart and souls into it.
That's a beautiful way of putting it.
Okay, I think we've maybe got time for one more question out there.
Oh, someone here.
Third row. Fourth row back.
Oh, yeah, I can't count.
Thank you. To me, it was great art of a fairy tale. And it was wonderful. And I loved going back to Japanese history for people who don't know much about it, but seeing the film, they get introduced, and then it was a great family film. Wonderful for children, wonderful for the parents. It had something for everybody, and I think it was an unforgettable film, and I wonder whether it's the top of the Ghibli productions.
Oh, that is a perfect statement to end on, because we did warn our panelists earlier that we were going to put them on the spot at the end of the question and answer session and say what their favourite Ghibli film is. I think Raina wants to go last, that's why she's motioning out to Hiromi first.
Well, until I watched this film, it was The Spirited Away, but I really, really like Princess Kaguya for the reason because it actually really tells that how the visual power is important to tell the story based on the things I said before, that it can really beautifully visualize the text, and then you can just follow the story just visually. So I really like this film.
Well, I'm just trying to quickly look up your list, because listeners to the podcast will know that at the end of every episode, I force Michael to rank his favourite films. And I'm quickly trying
to embarrass
look up
me in front of
where
here,
this one came. Let's go to someone else whilst okay. I find that up and can embarrass you in front
What's
of
What's your favourite Ghibli film?
Definitely this film is one of them. Because of the, I also grew up in the countryside in Japan, and the Takahata really shows the beauty of life in the countryside, and the, some of the actions or scenes they really close to what I experienced, and it shows beautifully to the world. So I really liked it, and also I like this film because this film doesn't fall into the stereotype of the recent Japanese animation. For example, big sparkling eyes like Mirabel, or it's just this. In speech, unspeakable beauty that Kaguya had is depicted a really simple line, like the calligraphy on a Japanese painting. So I think definitely this film is the one which can show the Japanese wonderful the culture.
That's a very, very well put. Thank you. Raina, the time has come.
Okay. As an academic, I have to say Princess Mononoke. Ooh, I wrote my PhD on Princess Mononoke, and I just edited a book on Princess Mononoke. I feel like it's the gift Miyazaki gave everyone that just keeps on giving. Theoretically, it's hugely important, and it's really important because it's the moment where Miyazaki sets out his stall as a public intellectual, not just an animator.
Yeah.
So he really does kind of lift the whole tone of animation at that point, I think. But as I've been doing more research on Studio Ghibli, the person behind the scenes, the one that gets no credit for all of the amazing work that Miyazaki and others at Ghibli does, is Takahata. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the more I watch his films, the more they give you. I think, go back and watch them all. They're all amazing.
Thank you for saying that about Princess Mononoke, because I'm trying to convince Jake that that's one of the best. He wasn't a big fan of that one, and that's what we fall out over all the time.
Yeah, and actually, in a great twist to end the evening, I've just found your list, and you never put Kaguya on it.
it's out of date.
Yeah. To recap for everyone in the room, from 17th to first place.
Jake.
Sorry. Tales from Earthsea, The Cat Returns, Arrietty, Howl's Moving Castle in 14th.
What?
He'll be outside ready for a fight later.
Oh, God.
When Marnie Was There, Pom Poko, Only Yesterday, Ponyo, Castle in the Sky, Spirited Away in 8th. Porco Rosso, The Wind Rises, Kiki's Delivery Service, Princess Mononoke, Grave of the Fireflies, My Neighbor Totoro, Whisper of the Heart.
Whisper of the Heart. Who's seen Whisper of the Heart in here? It's great, right? It's the secret best Ghibli film, and it's not made by either Miyazaki or Takahata. It's by Yoshifumi Kondo. It's impossible, isn't it?
Like, yeah. It's ask me which day of the week it is, and I'll have a new, you know,
it's
film
like
for you.
All of my favorite children, and then Tales from Earthsea. Yeah.
Oh!
Jake, what's your favourite?
Mine is Porco Rosso.
So the
I love Porco Rosso. I think it's great. And secretly, Miyazaki's most feminist film.
Ooh, okay.
No?
That's really...
That's the film where they were running over time on making Only Yesterday. So what Miyazaki did was he promoted women who hadn't had a chance to lead at Studio Ghibli and gave them their first shot.
Yeah, that's why I think the scene about building the plane in the workshop is all about that.
Fantastic. Well, if you want to see more about building planes in workshops,
yeah.
This time next week we are showing The Wind Rises here with another panel and Q&A, so please come along if you'd like to see that. Yeah. But for now, we've run out of time, and it just leaves me time to thank Hiromi, Hitomi and Reina for bringing the expertise this evening. And Jake, where can people find more about us?
Well, just search for Ghibliotech on Acast, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. We've gone through 18 of them so far. We'll be doing the rest and a few more as well. And do come and talk to Michael for a fight about those rankings as well.
Thank you so much for sticking around with us. Thank you so much for
Thank
everything.
You all for coming.
Have a lovely evening.
And that was our conversation after a screening of The Tale of the Princess Kaguya. Thanks again to Hiromi, Hitomi and Reina for joining us and sharing their insights with us. And no thank you to Jake for embarrassing me in front of a room ranking my favourite Ghibli films. The coldness of the air when you mentioned where Howl's Moving Castle landed on my list.
I know. And all those people that actually did wait around to have a fight afterwards. I hope those bruises have recovered now.
We should say thank you again as well to Bryony and Freddie and the British Museum team for allowing us to talk about Ghibli in front of such a rapt audience. Mm. And of course, this isn't the last of the series, is it, Jake?
No, we have got one more and a really terrific discussion that I'm really excited to be able to put out on the podcast with a guest who I know we had plans to have come on for a later episode, but it was just some good luck that Alex Dudok-Devitt was able to come on and tell us all about The Wind Rises and give us a lot of insights into that we weren't really able to cover on the episode that we recently did on it.
And likewise, it was such a wonderful pleasure to welcome back Nicole Roumenière, who was on our first panel to wrap things up into a nice tidy bow, finishing off this series of screenings. In the meantime, if you want to keep up with what we're doing, we are both on Twitter. You can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
And Michael at Michael J. Leader.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Meisner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel.
Hey, Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.